大约就是一个做农业，做了根据上有主播说啥也知道，就拿了就觉得当年就说，大约就是一个做农业，做了根据上有主播说啥也知道，都有就那么，讲究不多，当年就说些，大约就是一个做农业，做了根据上有主播说，俺给都在你做呢，到我他们这帮别去了，他们去年就在帮俺哥在那拉家子了，多年以前从头就别拿，现在是习惯，今天就。
那可是，我这当中，我说的呀，借根据的，看来那米格瓦的，也是那米格瓦酒，那米格酒那呢，他说，马金巴林巴塞的，那米格瓦旅游过来的，米格瓦的来马金巴林巴塞的，一个休息的呢，大概就是那马金巴林巴，古马古埃那第一呢，可是，古马的那个古维的第八天来呀，第八，你钱包他穷，挣的，穷了，什么过的，就那。
이거 두스티네
Good evening, everyone. So last time we continued with looking at the 10 non-virtuous actions, and we finished the presentation on killing, and we started with, and we also did the presentation on taking what's not given or stealing. So here, so stealing can be done on a great magnitude, that of middling strength, and that of least strength. So depending on the strength of the act of stealing, and if it's and it being a complete act, then the strength of the ripening results will vary. So the propelling karma that comes from a complete act of stealing would ripen in a rebirth in one of the three lower realms. So if it's a particularly powerful act of stealing, it would ripen in a rebirth in the hell realm, and if it's a middling act, as the rebirth would ripen in the preta realm, and if the act of stealing or the act of taking what's not given was of a lesser strength, then that complete karma would ripen as a rebirth in the animal realm. So, and last week when we looked at this, we also spoke about how we should counter this by when we rise in the morning to make the commitment that today I will not engage in any act of stealing. And so the reason we should make this as a firm commitment each morning is not because we necessarily steal particularly often, but it's through making a strong determination and making this promise that that this mind will slowly start to increase in strength, and thereby the virtue that is accumulated by making this commitment repeatedly, this virtue will grow and will strengthen. And then the ripening result of guarding our ethical conduct in this way, as you've seen previously, will be that it would ripen as a propelling karma in a rebirth in the happy realms, such as a human rebirth. And attaining a human rebirth, and with the other causes that are required to make it a precious human rebirth, we would then be able to continue with our Dharma progression. So that's what we looked at last week.
Oh yeah, that
So of the three physical non-virtues, we've now looked at two, and we come to the third one tonight, that of sexual misconduct. The presentation on sexual misconduct is divided into that of the object, that of the circumstance, and that of the time. Just to say, we're on page
107.
So the presentation here in the text starts off by identifying the audience for this teaching on sexual misconduct, and that is it's for the lay community. Because for the ordained community, then the practice is that of celibacy, so the total refrainment from all acts of sexual contact. So for the lay community, here the presentation is to do with sexual misconduct. So the first type of restraint in terms of sexual misconduct is restraining from engaging in adultery, so engaging with a sexual partner other than one's partner, one's spouse. So from acts of adultery, then problems, really large problems, can come, and this is the situation really everywhere. So in my own home country, the place where I'm from, if there's a problem in a relationship, then often it has to do with this. From the people in the community that I'm from, so from in North India, so there, if there's problem in a relationship, it's often to do with this, it's with adultery and the like, and it's seldom to do with anything like problems to do with one's work or anything like that. So really, from sexual misconduct, many problems do come.
Mm-hmm.
Some time ago, some people that I know from the same area, they came to us advice, or one of them came to ask me advice. So they were a couple before, and they're separated, and they're thinking about whether to get back together or not. So the first thing I said to them was whether they choose to come back together or not, that is their choice. So if they stay apart or they recommit to each other, then that is their choice.
Gazi John, you named the Deva Inna, that named the Dena, and the Karja or Lamna, and it Jibui in that house among the Bomina, house among the Guru, rather. Trodu Boogie and it Toya Delia, so we came in my packet, Boma Deva, that Ningjo, that Toya Mongurua. Toya in there, did you name the Jesse Vichella? That's also came in the Digilatan because Gaso Choshi Chevor, yes. Mato Anjik Dile Ninja do Dia Ninja Woods and Delia, Lapacha, Delia, Jordis, and Toya Union Mars.
Then furthermore, my advice to them was, if you do choose to recommit and to become a couple once again, then when you move around the village and or go to the town, you will see other people. You will meet other people, and you will see some which are more beautiful or more handsome than your partner, or have a more desirable personality, and you may think would actually make a better partner. So having these thoughts, they come. This will happen. But if you make this commitment to if you make this decision to commit to each other, then you have to be content with your partner and accept your partner for who they are, and not allow the mind to dwell on the perceived greater advantages of someone else, and rather to really strive to develop this mind of contentment with your partner. So I gave this advice really stressing this main point of being content, developing this mind of contentment with one's partner. Because if this couple were to, or these two people were to recommit and become a couple once again, then if one of them forms even just a good friendship with someone else, then their partner is likely to get jealous, and then arguments will start, and these arguments will escalate, and then the one's mind will be unhappy, the other partner's mind then will also be unhappy, and they will engage in non-virtue from having these unhappy minds and then expressing them verbally, etc. So then they'll be creating non-virtue, and nothing may have happened, But because of the minds of jealousy and the like that will arise, non-virtue will be created by both parties. And in fact, the disharmony could easily grow to where it starts to get expressed physically. And in this way, of course, the negativity escalates. So it's really to prevent this kind of non-virtue that the Buddha gave this advice on sexual misconduct, or the advice on how to avoid sexual misconduct, what behavior to abandon so as not to engage in sexual misconduct. So the Buddha gave this advice so that couples could refrain from engaging in or accumulating negativities, because through engaging, accumulating negativities, lower realm rebirths will follow. Suffering within rebirths will follow. So it's to prevent that from happening that the Buddha gave this teaching on sexual misconduct. So this really is the main point here in this section. And so to take this the concepts of adultery, so this could work in maybe both directions. So either if in a part and between two people, if one of them has a relationship outside, that would be adultery. Or if someone doesn't have a partner but has a relationship with someone who is in a relationship, then that too would be adultery and included within sexual misconduct.
Further illustrations
that's given here in the text is if from the perspective of a wife, if she is pregnant, and especially in the more advanced stage of pregnancy, or if she's ill, then if she has sexual relationships with her husband, even though they are together, their husband and wife, this would still be sexual misconduct, because it would incur some giving some, because the wife, for example, is ill, then she would have some difficulty, so therefore it should be avoided in times like that, or likewise for the child in an advanced stage of pregnancy. And furthermore, if the sexual partner is young, so then this too would be included in as a sexual misconduct.
Bulya chikpuchwe ki lumba dene ki chik lukse chuyoba ina di lumba dila da dakara chikpare da bu ina da, boma ina da, lose chungchung le tupse tan chuyo maare
dana chikpare kudari di tama gena?
Bu ina da, boma ina da, lose malangwa lo chungchung le andu tupse tan chik lute chikyo maare di da dene ki lukse yue chikin dila nika chikpare, nika
So in the Tibetan text, the gender is as if the advice was being given to men, to about women. So in our English, it's more gender neutral. So Genda's just saying that the presentation, whilst in the Tibetan it is gender specific, it's actually, the meaning is gender neutral, as our English generally is.
Now, the need in it, and that law in Rochi, the need that Dondala, Karungres, and the Niggi Cheva, and that your Raman will eager rather, and your Raman would dig bomb or say that the Nigger Ganga Chi do Martin Chi Java, Chi do Martin Chi, the Nigger Ganga Yung Yaza, and Jesu Madison, the Nigger and then Tibachimosaki, yes, a law him said it, the Nigger.
So again, the reason for presenting why the Buddha taught how to avoid sexual misconduct, or what constitutes sexual misconduct, is to prevent the accumulation of non-virtue and its resulting suffering. And of course, in the short term also, it helps prevent the experiencing of many problems and difficulties that comes from engaging in sexual misconduct. So this is the presentation on the 10 non-virtues, of the three relating to physical non-virtues. So we had the killing, stealing, and now thirdly, sexual misconduct. So for these three physical non-virtues that we've now looked at, so as to not incur negativities, one merely does not need to engage in the activity. So whether you have the intention not to engage or just do not engage in activity, then one doesn't accrue the negativity of having committed, for example, killing or stealing or sexual misconduct. However, so as to accrue virtue from not engaging in the act, here we need to generate an intent. So in the same way as we spoke with killing and with stealing, it's the same with sexual misconduct. If you're making the firm intent, for example, in one's motivation for the day that one sets in the morning, if you're making the firm intent that I will not engage in these physical non-virtues of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, to making that firm intent, one accumulates virtue, because there's been this active mind involved. And the more regularly one does this, for example, every day, then this mind will become stronger, more powerful, and therefore the virtue will become that much greater. So if someone, for example, doesn't think like this, and they just don't engage, for example, in sexual misconduct on one day, or they don't steal, just because they haven't met the opportunity, then yes, they haven't accumulated any negativity, But for sure, they haven't accumulated any virtue because there wasn't that intent. So therefore, it's important to repeatedly generate this intent that one will refrain from engaging in such negativities. Again, so the reason why it's important to actively cultivate this mind of not engaging in these three physical non-virtues is so that we can not just refrain from creating negativity, but so that we can actually accumulate virtue. So therefore, it's important to include this in one's morning meditation. Moreover, one probably doesn't usually get many opportunities to engage in these kinds of acts of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct and the like. But if one, as many people do, they don't think about these things much, and then the opportunity comes, and they may well engage in something. And afterwards they look back to, oh, that's not how I usually behave. But because they haven't engaged in a thought process, then when the opportunity unexpectedly comes and unusually comes, they may well engage in the non-virtuous activity. So therefore, cultivating this mind in terms of one's daily motivation not only accumulates virtue, but should or when one is presented with such an opportunity to engage in non-virtue, then if this mind has been cultivated repeatedly, it will serve to prevent one from engaging in such a negative act. So that is a second reason to include this contemplation in our morning motivation. So thinking in this way, not only do we now not engage in non-virtue, but we accumulate virtue. And this virtue that we accumulate, this is the virtue of guarding our ethical conduct, because we actively deciding, I will not harm other beings, I will not kill other beings. I will not harm other beings through engaging, through taking what's not given. I will not harm other beings through engaging in sexual misconduct. So here we are guarding our ethical conduct, we're protecting our ethical conduct. So this virtue then we know ripens as forms as a propelling karma, which will ripen as a rebirth in a happy migration, a rebirth as a human or as a god. And of course, to attain happy migrations, to avoid low realm rebirths, this is what we all want. For the ordained, as we said earlier, the situation is different. So here, for the ordained, then there's no sexual activity that can be engaged in. And if an ordained person does engage in sexual activity, then it's questionable whether they could be called ordained. So if an ordained person, for example, if a monk sleeps with a woman or a nun sleeps with a man, then they really should not, they should no longer wear robes anymore. Previously in ancient Tibet, one of the kings made the rule that the different types of Dharma practitioners must be easily identified, easily identifiable by what they wear. So the ordained should wear the robes of the ordained. Those who are nakpas, who engage in Dharma practice but do not have the vows of celibacy, then the clothes they wear should be different, and these should be easily these should be distinct, and therefore thereby easily distinguishable. So from the time of the Buddha, the Buddha himself established that the ordained should wear identifiable robes, and only the ordained should wear those robes. So in Tibet, when monks disrobed and tulkus also when they disrobed, then they would no longer wear the robes, the ordained robes, but they would wear a chupa, so dress like everyone else. So for example, the previous Panchen Rinpoche. So when he disrobed, then he no longer wore monk's robes, but wore a chupa like everyone else. So here in the West, it's a little different. Sometimes those who have disrobed, they may still wear robes, they may have long hair, etc. So this isn't correct. It shouldn't be like this. Mamma,
지기 최유 또 내서 한 모관들이 가르치나 지기에서 제 고행전에 네 지금 담담만에 미자제 김님들에 대해 자세하고 된지 등하로 도와드니 뒤서 지겨워 말다.
So in the world, certain types of employment for specific reasons are identified through the uniform that they wear. So we see many examples of this in society, that for example, emergency workers and the like, or those in the military, they wear easily identifiable uniforms because their clothes or the uniform they're wearing identify what role they engage in and what is expected from them in certain circumstances. So it's exactly the same with those who have the vows of the ordained. They should wear the robes of the ordained. But those who either have returned their vows or broken their vows or who are not ordained, they should not wear the robes of the ordained. So maybe in the West not everyone knows this, either those talkers don't know this or their students don't know this, and therefore there are situations where people wear the robes of the ordained, but they have children, they have a husband or a wife, and so this really isn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we've now looked at the three of the ten non-virtuous actions, the three to do with the physical non-virtues, and now we start on the verbal non-virtues, with the first one being lying. So what is lying? Lying is when a person motivated by the afflictions engages in verbal conduct with intention to deceive others or to confuse others. So there's this the first component of motivated by the afflictions, or have an afflicted motivation rather. So in the motivation, the afflicted minds are dominant, and then the motivation is to deceive or to confuse others.
The
types of lying can be are divided here into three: ordinary lies, major lies, and phony lama lies.
这么来的军学用不得
So the first type, ordinary lies, so this is the small kinds of lies that people tell quite commonly. So if something hasn't been seen, if something has been seen, saying that it hasn't been seen, or something that hasn't been seen, saying that it has been seen. So this kind of small lie. It would also include if people are joking around and the like, but with this intention to deceive the other person. So this is included within the ordinary types of lies.
Then
the major lies. So here, illustrations as we have here in the text, so we'd be saying, for example, no benefit comes from engaging in the practice of the Buddha Dharma. So in other words, saying that from engaging in a virtue, benefit doesn't come. Or saying engaging in what we'd call non-virtuous activity, no suffering results will come, no negativity will be accumulated. So for example, if you were to kill, no negative results would come from that. So these are included in major lies. And then also saying, for example, that Pure Lands don't exist when they do, or saying that the Buddha doesn't exist when the Buddha exists. So those are also included within major lies.
And in Nigi, Lamichulami Junisadi, da? Tiso, Benemoshi, Michulami Junisin, me, Chil, the Teo, just Jaga, Moshi, Sada, and Lam Sada, the Nigi, Topa, Kule, Kime, Magena, Kiris, if you go out, I have done Dalia, Nale, Moshi, Sada. Then the next day, Nalingi, Lam, Kule, Kiswa, Sada, the Nigi Shavina, and Jun.
And the third type, which are also great lies, would be this division of phony lamas lies. So here it's claiming to have clairvoyance when one doesn't, claiming to have attained a path when one doesn't, and here again this is a motivation to deceive the other person.
Jie 可能我是原来我是特别是什么人
And another illustration would be of these phony lama lies would be with the wish to deceive others and by pretending that one has qualities and attainments that one doesn't, then saying that an object that people don't normally see, for example, gods, oh, I converse with the gods, I see the gods. And the person who would be telling such a lie to others would have the, would most probably have the hope that the others would think, oh, this person must have clairvoyance and other attainments so as to be able to converse with hidden beings. So having such a motivation, or having motivation to deceive others and telling lies such as this is included within the phony lama lies. For a lie to become a lie, then it needs to be said and heard, said and understood by the other party. And then furthermore, the lies, as previously, can be divided into strengths. So if it's a lie of greater strength, then it would have the ripening results of being of propelling a rebirth in the hell. If it's a middling strength, it would have middling results of a rebirth in the preta realm. And if it wasn't a lie of great strength, then it would have the ripening result of propelling a rebirth in the animal realm.
And 미셰엔 데로 고호 땅 거선 미군노 요 말이네 그 노르 니셰 지는 고호 태송 말이 이네 니 균책 말이
So as always the motivation is very important. So within the motivation there needs to be this wish to deceive others. If this is absent, so for example one says something mistakenly, then this doesn't constitute lying. So there needs to be the motivation to deceive others. So just a mere mistake wouldn't constitute lying. So for example, when I'm teaching, if I'm not entirely sure and I say, well, it's probably like this, then that's because I don't really know. So I'm saying what I think, and I think it's probably like this. So if it turns out that I'm mistaken, then that's all it was. I was mistaken. I wasn't intentionally setting out to deceive you. So, for sure, sometimes I'll make mistakes, and then later, if you come to find out that something that I said was mistaken, then that's all it was. I wasn't out to deceive anyone. So, it was just an honest error.
Is that need them?
However, if I had the motivation to deceive you, then this definitely would be a lie. So, Degana ka petu tanke yomare, supo yang petu tang togere. Kere kida namdu. To engage in the act of lying, one doesn't have to. One doesn't only lie with humans, one can lie with other beings too. For example, with a dog. So if we pretend to throw food for a dog, the dog gets all excited and maybe jumps up for the food, but there's nothing, we're just pretending. Or maybe we throw a little stone and the dog was expecting food. Then this would also be a lie. So the person that we are willingly trying to, or the being we are willingly trying to deceive, can be doesn't have to be a human, and can also therefore be through a physical behavior, not necessarily verbal, although it's classified as verbal. Another illustration of lying with one's body as opposed to one's speech is if someone has lost something and asks you, have you found it or do you know where it is? And you do know where it is, but or you maybe found it yourself, but you don't say this. Rather, you pretend to be looking around as if you're helping them, but really, you know that if you tell them you've got it or you know where it is, you have to return it. So you, wanting to deceive them, you rather don't say anything but pretend to be helping them look.
Dilly or
This third type of lying, this phony lama lies, so then this really relies, the people who are greatest danger of creating of telling such a lie would be people who propound the Dharma, so Dharma teachers. Because those who don't teach the Dharma, it's not so likely that they would tell lies such as that. However, it's not only Dharma teachers who can engage in such lies. Our students too, whether lay or ordained, can also make such lies. So wanting to impress their fellow students, they may well pretend to know something, to pretend to know something that they don't know. So they set out to deceive their fellow students with the hope that the fellow students will generate great faith and confidence in them, or think maybe that they have wonderful qualities that they don't have, such as clairvoyance and the like. So it is certainly possible for Dharma students to tell this kind of lie as well.
So if
we hear that someone has great attainments such as clairvoyance and the like, then it's important we don't just readily accept this. We need to investigate, we need to go away and think for ourselves. So if someone claims to have clairvoyance, we can, of course, investigate this quite directly just by asking them things that they would only know with their clairvoyance. So if they want to make such a claim, we certainly can challenge them on that.
Mm-hmm.
So some time ago in Tibet, there are many people claiming to see gods and gods enter into them and the like. So a leader in the area, he maybe got a bit fed up with this, with all these people making the claims. So he decided to put it to the test. So he sent out a notice inviting all these people to come together on a specific day, and he advised them beforehand that he'd be making a large fire on top of a sheet of metal, because if what they say is true and that gods do enter into them, then whilst they are maybe, I don't know if we say possessed, but while they're possessed by the god, they would be able to pick up this red hot metal, and they wouldn't burn themselves. So the leader, he made this announcement, and then all of these people who had been making claims that they saw gods and the like, out of all of them, only one or two people came forward and were able to prove that they do converse with the gods, or the gods do enter into them. All the others, they just stayed away or melted away. So this is just a story I've heard. I've never read it in a book, so one doesn't really know if it's true, but this is something I've heard. So if someone makes claims to have tantric realizations to do with the generation and the completion stage, then they, having made these claims, they may try to say they can now engage in a variety of unusual behavior, such as wearing the robes of an ordained but having a partner, a wife or a husband and the like. So if someone makes such claims, then it's not just for us to accept that and say, oh, how wonderful, this is great that you can do these things. But if they are making those claims, then they should substantiate them. So if someone has such attainments, then they will have magical powers. And so, for example, they should be able to cut off their arm and without suffering from this, without experiencing any problem, and reattach the arm and the like. So if someone wants to make such claims, then they should prove those claims, and we should expect that of them. Lord Buddha himself, he said that if someone has the high attainment of being a foe destroyer, they should not announce that. That should be kept secret. So likewise, if others have the great attainments of the tantric path, those two should be kept secret. So therefore, one shouldn't encounter people who make these claims about themselves, because the Buddha himself said that these things should be kept, or such attainments should be kept secret. And we can see a very clear illustration of this with His Holiness. So His Holiness says, oh, I have great respect for the mind of Bodhicitta. I'm training and trying to cultivate this mind, but I have not yet even begun to attain this mind of Bodhicitta. So when His Holiness is showing this kind of example, it's very clear how everyone else should behave, and that people should not be making bold claims about what they have attained. And we can see this, an illustration of this maybe in the world, where if someone says, oh, this product that I'm selling is really fantastic and make many claims about it, we wouldn't just accept what they say. We would then investigate, we'd find out from other knowledgeable people and the like, and knowing that people may make claims about something for ulterior motives. And that in the world is quite normal, and it's also quite normal not just to blindly accept whatever people claim. So likewise, we should relate that type of thinking to spiritual practitioners who make claims about themselves as well. So it's very possible that people such as these, we could encounter or hear about them and the like. So here it's important that we hear what is said about them, even if it comes from people that we know and like and trust, and think about what's said and make our own decisions for ourselves, because then things may well turn out well. But if we don't investigate, we don't think carefully, and we too readily accept what other people say, then problems can come. The second of the four verbal non-virtues is that of divisive speech, and we're calling it sowing discord. So here on page 108, so the second of the four verbal non-virtuous actions is sowing discord. So this can be done in different ways. So for example, when two people have a harmonious relationship, they have a harmonious relationship, and then someone having an afflicted motivation, or a motivation where the afflictions are dominant, speaks in a divisive manner, trying to separate these two harmonious people, trying to create a rift between them. And this would be an illustration of a divisive speech or sowing discord. The text divides divisive speech into two, openly sowing discord and secretly sowing discord.
That's
So to give an illustration of the first one, that's openly sowing discord. So as it says here in the text, often this is done by someone who has some authority. And so where they have two people, and they would, in front of, or before both people, they'd say, this person said X, Y, and Z about that person, or about you. So he said this about you. And so what was allegedly said by this person may be true, maybe they said that, maybe they never said it, but it is now being made up. But this is being done, whether it's true, with what this person actually said something or not, or did something or not, isn't so important. It's not whether this person is lying. Rather, it's they have the motivation to sow discord, to destroy the harmony between these people, these two people, and to try and create a rift between them and separate them and destroy the good relationship that they have. So again, this person who may have some authority could be telling something that's not true, or could be telling the truth, but they have this afflicted motivation of wanting to sow disharmony between the two people. Last time, in the previous 2 weeks, we've spoken about these four features of whether an action becomes a complete action or not. So we spoke about the basis, the intention, the performance, and the completion. So here, in the context of divisive speech, the basis would be two people who can understand what is being said. The intention would be this afflictive motivation to sow discord between two people. And the performance will be engaging in the speech. And the completion is when they have heard and understood what has been said. It's for there to be a complete act. The two people hearing do not have to become disharmonious. They just need to hear. So in other words, a person who's being engaging in divisive speech, whether it achieves the result they want or not, it doesn't make a difference. The other two people just need to hear and understand. The second type of sowing discord is very similar to the first. The secretly sowing discord, the only the difference here is that the person who is engaging the divisive speech will speak separately to the other party, so not to them together. So the performance, the first of the four stages is there's the object, so the person needs to hear and understand, and then the intention is an afflictive motivation to divide people, and then they engage in the speech, the performance, and the completion is when the person has heard and understood. And then they would go away possibly and create divisive speech elsewhere and do the whole process again. So whether the relationship between the two people who are being spoken about, whether that relationship remains harmonious or actually becomes disharmonious, is not required for the act to be complete. Rather, they just need to hear and understand, and then the act would be complete. And then also, as previously, the person engaging in divisive speech, what they're saying, whether it's true or untrue, that also doesn't matter in terms of whether the speech is divisive or not. So what does happen in the world is if there are two people that have a relationship, whether it's a good relationship or a bad relationship, but they at least know each other. And so let's say they're having some difficulties and they come and speak to a third person and say, oh, you won't believe what happened, and they have a good complaint. And then the person hears this, they may well engage in divisive speech and respond in a way with the motivation to separate the one person from the other. And in this way, with this motivation to create disharmony and to separate the two people, they could very, very easily engage in divisive speech. The text gives three illustrations of the strongest type of divisive speech. So the first of the three would be creating a schism in the ordained community, so creating a divide in the Sangha. So this would be the one of the strongest types of divisive speech. Another of the amongst the strongest types would be to create disharmony between a teacher and their students, so between a Dharma teacher and their students. So that would also be a very strong form of divisive speech. And the third strong form of divisive speech is to create disharmony amongst Vajra brothers and sisters. So those who have received initiation from the same teacher, then they have a special bond together. And creating here disharmony between those students, this is also a very powerful form of divisive speech.
on the Nigi, not Tama said it, Tama said it, not that Dandala, Tama said it, so Sugi Kulung and Basiki, Chicken, Chapo, Kadjasa Koro, Kariwans, and Yomobu, Ongi, Kuni, Lange, Mini, Shanda, Shanda, Tumbu, Yabala, Tumbu, Mava, Sawas, and Biggie, Kuni, Lange, the Nigi, Joachi, Paji, Jay, Suji, Shade, Dinny Shade, and the Pajo de Lugosana, it Tama said.
So again, again for sowing discord, we have the four requirements. So the basis needs to be the other person that you're going to speak to and who can understand what is being said, hear and understand. One needs to have an afflicted motivation, so a motivation where the afflictions are dominant. Then one engages, the third step is the performance, the engaging in the activity of divisive speech. And the completion is when the speech is heard and understood. The third of the four types of verbal non-virtuous actions is harsh speech. So harsh speech can take many forms, but the result is similar in that it brings unhappiness to the mind of others. So there are a few examples given here of harsh speech, and we know this well from our own experience too. But calling someone stupid, or calling someone blind, or calling someone ugly, these are illustrations of harsh speech, and they serve the result to make the other person unhappy. The strongest form of harsh speech would be harsh speech to someone who shows a particular kindness, or the greatest kindness to oneself, such as one's teacher or one's parents. So harsh speech directed to them, this is the gravest form of harsh speech. There's a story about a lama in the past who was easily enraged. And so the students, observing this repeatedly, commented how he's like a dragon. Sorry, like a snake.
Do you say the
And so he likened his teacher to a snake because snakes get that they respond very quickly, or they show anger very quickly. So the karmic ripening result of insulting or speaking in a harsh manner to his teacher was being reborn himself as a snake. So it wasn't that he was reborn as a snake, but actually the ripening result came in that very life, and he fell over and he lost the use of his arms and his legs, possibly became paralyzed or the like. So in that very life, he, in terms of mobility, became like a snake. So and actually the strongest kinds of negativity can ripen in this life. There's also another well-known story about at the time of the Buddha. The Buddha and some monks were going on an alms round, and they needed to cross over a ditch or a drain with some water. So the monks jumped over this ditch, and one of the other monks said, "Oh, you just like to one of the monks who had jumped, or you just like a monkey." And so the ripening result of this was that he was reborn for 500 lifetimes as a monkey. So for this the harsh speech to be that much greater, then it needs to be directed towards an object such as one's teacher or one's parents, so a great object, so to speak.
Then
So tonight we've looked at four of the non-virtuous actions. We started with sexual misconduct, then lying, divisive speech, and harsh speech. So with all of these, once they've been accumulated in their complete form, they have the ripening result of propelling a lower realm rebirth, because they are contrary to guarding one's ethical conduct. So being born in the lower realms, of course, the suffering, as we learned previously, is that the suffering there is intense. Of course, all of us, we want to be free of such severe suffering. We want to be free of any kind of suffering. Therefore, it's imperative that we abandon such non-virtuous actions. Because if we abandon these actions and abandon them completely, we close the door on accumulating further causes to attain rebirth in the lower realms. And by closing, we are stopping to accumulate these causes, then we will be so much less likely to be reborn in the lower realms in the future. Then furthermore, we need to, as we said at the beginning of the class tonight, we need to make the active decision repeatedly, I will not engage in these non-virtuous actions. So for example, in the morning when we set our motivation, we should make this clear motivation, there's clear intention that today we will not engage in these non-virtuous actions of killing and stealing and sexual misconduct and lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, etc. And it's not just saying these words, but saying it in a way that it's, or thinking about it, reflecting on it in a way that it's powerful and moves our mind. So thinking about the results that come from engaging in such negativities, how we will harm others, how we will harm ourselves. And we don't want to suffer, others don't want to suffer from us engaging in this way. And so not wanting to be the kind of person who, for example, speaks harshly or acts in a divisive manner, we make this firm commitment that I will not be such a person today, I will refrain from such an activity. And when such an opportunity arises, the opportunity arises where one can, for example, engage in harsh speech, I will refrain from that. I don't want to harm others. I don't want to suffer myself. So in this way, through generating a firm and clear motivation, we create virtue. And we're creating the virtue of guarding our ethical conduct, which has the ripening result of being propelling karma that leads to a happier migration. So if we make this motivation, and then we fulfill that motivation, in other words, we don't accrue negativities, we also accumulate virtue. Whereas if we just don't engage in the negative actions, we're not accumulating virtue. So therefore, it's imperative that we do this as part of our motivation. And as we've discussed previously, then during the course of the day, we should recall these minds and recall the commitment that we've made not to engage in non-virtue, and due to the reasons of not wanting to suffer, not wanting to harm others and the like. And in this way, we will keep that motivation present and we will strengthen the virtue we accumulate. And lastly, in the evening, when we reflect on the day, we should recall, today I didn't engage in these negativities, I didn't kill, I didn't steal, I didn't engage in sexual misconduct, etc. And rejoice, generate a happy mind, because this serves to strengthen the virtue that we have accumulated. So it's a very easy way to accumulate even more virtue from having this mind of restraint. So in this way, we'll create the causes for good rebirths in the future, to have good, and for those rebirths to go well in terms of our Dharma accomplishment. And this way, our progression towards attaining our goals of becoming a bodhisattva, becoming liberated from the sufferings of samsara, attaining buddhahood and the like, they come about that much more quickly. And the next time we'll start at the bottom of page 108 with worthless chatter. So we'll start there next time. So some questions tonight.
I have about five, but I'm trying to think which one's the most important. I'll ask one, and then if no one else does, maybe two.
Sure.
So the first one, the definition, and correct me if I'm wrong about the definition, but the definition that I thought I heard was of lying, was that it's a person motivated by the afflictions, or having afflictive motivation, with the wish to confuse or deceive others. Well, the question goes to the first part. If you're not motivated by the affliction, is it a lie? Does it create negative karma?
Yes. So if you're not motivated by the afflictions, but you say something to deceive someone, is this a negativity?
Yes.
Okay. So to answer that, there's an illustration. So if a hunter approaches you and says, which way did the rabbit go? And you know you just saw the rabbit bounding away. And if you were to give the honest answer, the hunter would maybe be happy with you, but he would end up killing the rabbit. So you lie and you say it went in a different direction. So from this, you're telling a lie, so you create negativity. However, because your motivation is primarily one of compassion, so then the merit will be that much greater. So you could really even say no fault will come from such a lie, because of the imbalance between the two. The virtue that is created is so much greater than the negativity that is created from telling something. Not that it's a small lie, but it's because of the dominant virtuous motivation. Okay.
Just just an observation. Peter was talking about the questioning the teachings and everything like that. And I was just wondering what in the West we seem to divide without questioning our politicians, our teachers, our parents. So it doesn't seem in some cases that it's easy for us to actually do these questions. Is it a very important thing that we actually do questions? And how do we actually go about this question of the teachings?
Mm-hmm. So, just to say, of the teachings or of question the teacher? Teacher, I guess.
Teacher.
To see, okay. So, because we all too easily in the West, we just accept someone for who they present themselves as, for example, a teacher, a politician, etc. Yes.
Some people do.
Yes. So how to go about that? Also kanntest taro chegere kanna also katuk jya tang chuge mare den pelteri sugar also pena also den nangcho yapa ko ge mare deni kongsume lap yome also kanjo sa ko ge re di chiru tamade ne doje ne re di sugar ne
ni ro da chik na namsa la da mo ne gili gili chi ne ya chi shen da zan ne su ge yong ro da ne pen ne chik she wa ne di dan da la khala go re sa da
So to know is difficult. To know whether a teacher is a false teacher, if he has a deceptive motivation, a motivation to take advantage of others. This is difficult to know, and it takes time, and therefore the students should take time, and should look over a period of time. And if the teacher is lying and the like, then this will be done with the motivation to receive something in return. So this is something to look for. Do they maybe have a motivation to gain some advantage, to gain something? However, having said that, it's also difficult to really know what someone's motivation is. So it is difficult. But the key part of the advice was, it takes time, so one should examine over time.
So
these kinds of big lies, that, or these phony, the phony lama lies, these are not likely to start out in front of an audience. So when one is more at risk of hearing this is in a one-on-one or a small group. And so the illustration would be is if the teacher, for example, is a male and he's talking with a woman, and he could have ulterior motive. And here he's presenting his great attainments. Maybe he has realizations, saying he has realizations of Dzogchen, and that you are a Dakini, and etc. So this kind of story is more likely to, well, this kind of situation is more likely to happen in a small group, certainly initially, and not necessarily in a front, in a large group. And that's when one should maybe be extra vigilant. Okay. And just a sec. So if it's getting a bit late, because there are many questions, if some people need to go, really, that is fine. Cameron, that's fine.
Along similar lines to Pete's question, if a person, in relation to lying, if a person in conversation, it's fairly common to make a statement that is simply incorrect to another person, but not with the intention of deceiving them, but rather to determine if their understanding is correct. So, in other words, a statement is just directly made. An incorrect statement is directly made to the person. Whether or not they
can be true.
Yes. So
as to understand. So as to ascertain someone else's understanding of a topic, you may present something that's false, and something they therefore should know as false.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so would this then constitute a lie, and negative, would it result in negativity? Then So, in brief, no, because you don't have the motivation to deceive and to cheat and confuse someone. Well, maybe we don't say confuse, to cheat someone here. So it's exactly as you said, you don't have that kind of motivation, so therefore it's not a negative act, it's not lying. Okay, good, thank you. Pete? Another time. Okay. Then, thank you very much. Yeah,
Oh.